Hello, this is a show from Radia. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners. Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond. Are you up for it?
This is from Free 103.9, New York City, U.S.
Hi, I'm Matt Bua, working with Jesse Berkowitz, and for the next half hour, we're going to revisit a few of the people we've talked with for our past show called Things Got Legs at Derek Eller Gallery. The idea of being a story with legs, if followed freely, can lead you down some unexpected paths. First up, we'll talk with Peter Lavenda, author of The Unholy Alliance, A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult, and his new three-volume book entitled Sinister Forces, A Grimoire of American Political Witchcraft. He followed his own story with legs when back in 1979 he took a trip down to Chile to investigate the rumors of Nazi camps running unchecked medical experiments on the locals.
Well, Chile, I went down in 1979. Salvador Allende was overthrown in 73, actually on September 11th, 1973. That was the military coup in Chile, engineered by Nixon and Kissinger. They wanted Allende out. He was a socialist, a friend of Castro. Even though he was democratically elected, you know, and was the president in a regular election, Nixon told Kissinger in the Oval Office tapes, we've got to get rid of this guy. So they threw a lot of money behind the truck unions. And in Chile, which is a long, narrow country, the trucks are the lifeblood of the country, just moving the produce up and down the country. He got them to go on strike. They threw a lot of money behind the right-wing generals, and eventually in 73 they engineered a military coup. So I went down there in 79 because I was looking for something that I thought could not possibly exist, a place called Colonia Dignidad. And this was a Nazi estate in the Andes Mountains. I read about it. It had barbed wire, it had machine guns and anti-aircraft emplacements and everything else. And they were all Nazis, and they practiced weird rites in the jungles, you know, not the jungles, but the mountains. And I said, really? You know, is this possible? This sounds like a Robert Ludlum novel, you know, or a bad Robert Ludlum novel. So I went down on my own dime and just went to see it, you know, like an idiot. In 1979, the country's under martial law, right? The soldiers in Chile emulate the Wehrmacht. They have the Wehrmacht-style helmets. They goose-step. They do the whole thing. They have the knife. You know, my honor is loyalty. I mean, these guys are Nazis. I mean, they just, you know, they're Nazi wannabes. And the whole country was run by these guys. And I get down there and like an idiot, I want to go to Colonia Dignidad, you know. I'm 28 years old. I'm a New Yorker, so I don't know how to drive. It wouldn't have helped anyway. So I get a bus, you know, a regular bus, and it takes me down a couple of hours south into the country to this town of Parral, which the estate was located near. I get out of the bus in the middle of the night, it's like 4 o'clock in the morning. There's dogs howling and there's roosters crowing and it's deserted, you know, it's this little tiny town in South America and it's freezing. It's the summer for us, but the winter in South America. So it's cold, I'm wearing my trench coat, you know, I want to be visible, you know, as a gringo. So if anything happens to me, they can say, well, there was this white guy here, you know, just went up into the mountains. And a scene out of Fellini, there's this guy in a beret, you know, on a bicycle with a dog on a rope, and he comes out, you know, and he says, who are you and what are you doing here? And I said, well, I'm going to go to the train station. I'm waiting for a train. And he laughed. He says, there hasn't been a train here in years, you know. No, really, what are you doing here? So I eventually told him I was going to the colony. And he said, no, you don't want to do that. That's insane. And as we're talking, we're joined by two carabineros, two of the cops, which were militarized at that time. And we all hung out and started drinking in this guy's house, you know. I mean, they just thought it was great to see this North American guy down here. Like, what the hell are you doing here? Are you crazy? And I said, I want to go to the colony. And they said, no, you don't want to go there. You know, they have these weird rituals, and we hate them, and they're all Germans. They don't let us in there except for the clinic. They have a free clinic. And I said, a free clinic? Yeah. That's a German one with his hypodermic, you know, and you go in there, and it's free, like 2 days a week, you know. And if they're forced to, they'll take their kids there, but sometimes the kids don't come back. And all these weird stories, and these were the local people telling me this. Plus telling me that they were being financed by the whole world. They would, you know, one of their relatives worked in the bank and they were getting checks and wire transfers from the United States, from Europe, from everywhere. I said, well, that's, you know, that's pretty strange, but I'm here, I'm gonna go. And they said, you just turn around and go home, you know. But that morning, as the sun came up, I found a taxi and I gave the guy, you know, an exorbitant amount of money to take me up to the colony. And he says, okay, we'll go, but we'll come right back. And I said, no, it's no problem. So we go up to the mountains. It's dirt roads. There's the sort of gaucho types, you know, coming down with the Clint Eastwood hats and the serapes, you know, and they come riding past us, and we're going up and up and up. And we cross over a small bridge. There's a gate open. There's a big parking area, you know, and there's a house at the end of it. And you're in the colony. And I said, cool. I'm going to go out, take a few photographs, get back in the car, and we'll leave. So I get out, and I'm taking photographs of this place. I get back in the car. We turn around, and everything closes all around us. You know, it's the freakiest thing. Electronic gates close this way. A car comes out from I don't know where, because we didn't see a car anywhere. A white Mercedes. All these doors open. These big guys get out, and the whole place is surrounded. And my driver is just holding the wheel and going, uh-oh. Uh-oh. That's all he can say over and over again. Oh, no. Oh, no. You know, I roll down the window, and the phrase I've been waiting my entire life to hear, I heard. It was a German looking at me and saying, your papers, please. This can't be happening, right? So I give him my passport. I mean, what was I going to do? I mean, the place, we were not getting out of there. Right. And they took the camera and took the film out of the camera and took the passport away. And then they started interrogating. I didn't get out of the car. You know, never get off the boat, as they say, right? So I'm in the car, but the door's locked. They want to come and get me. They're going to, but. And the head of the colony, a guy called Paul Schaefer. Yeah. The only thing they had in common is they're both bald, and that was about it. This guy was wearing a Sam Brown belt and a little fatigue cap and the whole thing, German, and speaking in German to an interpreter who's talking to me in English, because I didn't want to argue for my life in Spanish, my Spanish not being that perfect. So we're having this conversation, and they're trying to find out what I'm doing there. And they're asking the driver, how many are there? When did they arrive? They assumed I was a Zionist. I was a Jew coming there to cause some problems. And that I worked for Mossad or something, which is ridiculous. I mean, I was even thinner then than I am now. It was like 120 pounds, you know, what was I going to do? But so they kept me there for about 20 minutes, half an hour or so, I don't know. They had a big discussion as to what to do. I was there in the presence of this driver. If they had done something to me, they'd have to take care of the driver as well, I think. So they let me go. They gave me back the passport, and they told me, go back to America. You're not welcome in this country. These are Germans telling me this in Chile. You're not welcome in this country. So that's bizarre. We were allowed to leave, and my driver floored it. I mean, we took us about an hour to get up to the colony. It took us about 20 minutes to get out. You know, this guy didn't care. He ran around oxen, and he was laughing the whole way. He was hysterical with relief that we had gotten. He says, you don't know how lucky you are. And we got back to the town. I get out of the cab. Two more police approach me and say, are you Lavenda? How the hell do they know my name? So I showed them the passport, they wrote it down, and they said, you were up at the colony. And they asked me a lot of questions. How many guns do they have? How many were there? I mean, like military intelligence questions. I'm thinking, you guys don't know? I go back on the bus, this sort of Pullman coach that goes back to Santiago, the capital. And about every 20 minutes or so, there's a roadblock. Soldiers get on the bus, and they ask for me to make sure I'm on the bus. I get back to the hotel in Santiago. There's a note saying I'm on the next flight. So they meant it when they say I wasn't welcome. These Germans somehow had connections. As I found out later, they were very tightly involved with Pinochet. And Pinochet was sending political prisoners to that colony to be tortured and executed. It was an interrogation center that I had wandered into like an idiot. I finally make it back to Miami. I wasn't going to Miami, but that was the next flight I was on. So I get off at Miami airport, and I'm dazed. I don't know what the hell is going on. Two of our people, two guys in black suits, are waiting for me at the airport when I go through customs immigration. They stop me, ask to see my passport. They kind of smile at me, smile at each other, give me back the passport, and walk away. They were waiting for me in the States. So that was the second level of complicity. And now I think, oh, I'm fucked now. You know. I got a newspaper in Miami when I got off the plane, and I opened the headlines on the newspaper were that the statute of limitations on Nazi war crimes had just been extended to be limitless. And I thought it was the day that I was down there that the German parliament was voting on this in Germany, in West Germany at that time. And I said, no wonder they let me out. They thought I was there to cause some problem, to bring attention to them, to create some kind of scene to affect the vote back in Germany. This is what they were thinking, I think. And I think it's the only reason I got out. I was just dumb luck. I had no clue this was happening. But to see that, you know, here I am looking for Nazis, and then for the Miami Herald to say, you know, guess what? So I put the two and two together and figured that was what was going on. Then a few weeks after I'm back, Jack Anderson, the investigative journalist at that time, in his column, article about Colonia Dignidad, you know, Amnesty International records, CIA records, and this and that, Operation Condor, and all this other stuff. And holy shit. And then later I find out the guy who engineered the assassination of Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C., the Chilean ambassador who was killed car bomb back in 75. The guy who engineered that was an American, Michael Townley, and he was the one who designed the interrogation center at Colonia Dignidad. He was an electronics expert. And what he did was he designed remote control torture chambers where a victim would be tied to a metal bed, which was attached with electronically back to a control system. And there was a guy in a control booth who had all these rooms connected to him with little TV sets. And he could remotely control the torture for each individual prisoner by turning up the juice or not. The prisoner would never see a human being. There would be microphones, there would be speakers, he'd be asked questions remotely, he would never see the person doing it. It was like a, you know, a satanic kind of arrangement. Plus they would pipe in music to cover the screen, so they, naturally it was Wagner, right? So you just imagine this weird, surreal thing. Underground chambers, remote control torture, Wagner piped in, and some German guy at the controls. I mean, you wouldn't believe it if you read it in a Vonnegut novel, but here it is in reality, created by this guy, Michael Townley, who's now in the Witness Protection Program in the United States. They've been asking him a lot of questions about Colonia Dignidad lately, because they finally raided the place, found a lot of strange stuff, found a lot of documents, found a lot of weapons that were buried, found entire automobiles that were buried in the earth, all kinds of strange stuff.
What year was that? It was raided?
It's been raided over the last couple of years.
So it's pretty recent.
Yeah, since I think the president at the time was Patricio Aylwin, which means it would be the late 90s, if I remember correctly, and they finally found Paul Schaefer. He went into hiding when they first raided. And when they say raid, they meant with the helicopters, half-tracks, tanks, and everything else, because this was a big colony. It was 30,000 acres, I think, the last I heard. Plus, they had landing strips there. They had their own planes coming in and out. They finally figured out they were running drugs, they were running arms. You know, Colonia Dignidad was a major center in what they called Operation Condor. This is where they were assassinating left-wing problem makers, you know, all over the world, not just in South America, but in Europe as well. And this was a major conduit, and they raised money. They were getting financed by what we call Odessa. Anyway, the Nazi underground was financing them. And that's part of the official record now in Chile. There's more to that story. I mean, it goes on and on, but it was just a bizarre operation. So they found Schaefer last year, hiding in Argentina. They brought him into Chile now to stand trial. He's already been convicted of 20 cases of child abuse. So that's done. But now they're going on to the other human rights abuses and the torture stuff. And the government's very nervous about going into that because there's going to be repercussions internationally due to probably some American involvement in that as well.
Right, but it's Chile looking into it, so
yeah,
they're
I mean, Condoleezza Rice was just down there, you know. Colin Powell was down there. They're all making nice with the Chilean government right now. They do not want this stuff about Colonia Dignidad coming out because it's just too sick and too seedy, you know. Mm. It's one thing, Abu Ghraib is one thing. You throw Colonia Dignidad behind it and it's, you know, wow. So.
That was Peter Lavenda, author of Unholy Alliance, A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult, talking about some of his adventures while researching his book. Up next is William H. Kennedy, author of Lucifer's Lodge, Satanic Ritual Abuse in the Catholic Church. He's going to talk about following the pedophile priest scandal after the 2002 revolutions to their darker, less talked about details.
Well, Lucifer's Lodge came about when I met Father Malachi Martin, which he actually pronounced as Malachi Martin, but he didn't care if people pronounced it different ways. Back in 1996, when I went down to New York to see him concerning a book about traditional Catholic priests I was thinking about writing at the time, and when I went down there in January of 1996, he told me something quite stunning. He said that Cardinal Bernard Law of Boston was running a pedophile ring. I'm from Boston myself, and that some of the pedophiles in this extensive ring were also Satanists. Now, back in 1996, that was about like saying Cardinal Bernard Law was seen flying in a UFO. You know, it seemed a very far-fetched and, you know, extraordinary claim. And I told Father Martin that, you know, I was very upfront. And I had spoken to Father Martin. I called him once a month over the next couple of years after that, and I went down to see him a few more times down in New York City. And we would occasionally talk about this satanic cabal, but when I was on the phone with him, I used to roll my eyes. I was highly skeptical of it, and that's primarily because my own experiences with the Roman Catholic Church were very good. I had gone to Catholic grammar school, Catholic high school, and my own experience, as I said, I enjoyed my time in the Catholic Church. You don't hear a lot of people say that, but my time went very well. So, and I also thought that the people who ran the church up here in Boston, like Bernard Law was a Harvard graduate, I always thought that people that educated would certainly be moral enough to get rid of pedophiles. So the combination of the two kind of made me skeptical. Now to fast forward a bit, Father Martin died in 1999 of cardiovascular trouble. And a couple years after that, in January of 2002, almost exactly 6 years after I had met Father Martin initially, the Boston Globe broke a story that the Cardinal Law in Boston was in fact running a pedophile ring of priests. It was a series of stories in January of 2002. And what I did for the next year and a half, I didn't have to do very much research. The Boston Globe was kind enough to do it for me. I just pulled together all of the articles that came out that involved pedophile priests who were also involved in different sorts of satanic ritual abuse or ritual abuse in general. And I didn't have to wait very long. About a month and a half after that, it came out that Monsignor Frederick J. Ryan, who was the vice chancellor of the Archdiocese of Boston, had tattooed a boy with a devil figure back in the early 80s. And sexually abused him down on Cape Cod. Now, Monsignor Frederick J. Ryan had also taken photographs of him and used them to blackmail this young man for many years for sex, even into adulthood. He would have homosexual sex with him. Now, this was not some fringe priest or some troubled priest. This was the person third in charge of the Archdiocese of Boston, a high, high position within the Catholic Church. So that was the first case, and all of these quite stunned me as they came along, you know? And the next case that came up was that of Father Sean Fortune in Ireland. Father Sean Fortune, his story was very suppressed and put on the back burner of coverage in the United States. He was charged with raping children in 1996, and he had raped them throughout the 80s and 90s, but when the parents would catch him, he would threaten them with satanic hexes. He would say that if you turn me into the authorities, Satan will haunt you. If you turn me into the authorities, your next child will be born crippled. He would do things of that nature, and he also took some of the children to Loftus Hall, which is a Catholic retreat house in Ireland, and that's kind of a place where Catholics go to get away from mainstream society and talk about their faith. And they take a lot of children along on these. And Loftus Hall had a history of being haunted, of having poltergeist activities. It was exorcised by a priest in the 1700s, Father Thomas Broders. And according to the Irish journalist Alison O'Connor, who worked for the Irish Times, Father Fortune took boys there to also, they had a room there called the Devil's Room, where he had held orgies with children. Now, I know these stories sound very far-fetched, and just to hear them just spouted out like this makes it sound like something fake, like satanic panic, but these are all documented within the Boston Globe, Irish Times. I repeat that when I tell these stories because a lot of people, when I just say them, they don't believe me without the documentation, and in a way, I don't blame them.
Okay, that was William H. Kennedy, author of Lucifer's Lodge, and his book Satanic Crime is due out shortly. Next, we're going to talk to Bart Sabrell, a filmmaker who has spent the last decade trying to disprove the authenticity of the Apollo moon landing missions. His website, moonmovie.com, has a lot of his evidence and clips from his films. One of them is he tries to track down as many astronauts as he can. He tries to get them to swear on the Bible if they actually went, and it's pretty entertaining, their reactions. And this is Bart Sabrell.
I wanted to start from the beginning, I guess, when you began to doubt that the Apollo missions were possibly not what they appeared to be.
Well, I was 14 years old, and at that time, my father was in the Air Force and got access to a great publicity package from NASA containing several 9x12 color prints of the first moon landing. So probably between the age of 8 and 14, I had an entire bedroom wall covered with pictures of the first moon landing because I was their biggest fan. Then when I turned 14, I was flipping channels and I saw this news magazine program that had as their guest a gentleman who worked for NASA during the time of Apollo from like 63 to 69, something like that. And he asserted quite confidently that the moon missions were number one, impossible, and number two, falsified as a Cold War tactic in order to make the Soviet Union believe we had equal or superior missile technology during the Cold War. Kind of like a bluff in poker. You know, we had two twos, they had three threes, we bet $500,000. And in fact, in 1994, without much fanfare, it was reported by the General Accounting Office that said the following about the Star Wars missile defense program. It said that Star Wars, let me quote it, rigged tests to make it seem more advanced than it really was. The aim was to fool the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And that's what he said. Basically, they could not go to the moon. Kennedy, not a scientist, but a politician, after the Soviets beat us into space, you know, they had the first satellite, first animal, first man, first woman, first spacewalk, first crew of three, first of two spacecraft at the same time. For every 20 hours we spent in space, they spent 100 hours. So much more advanced. Well, Kennedy, ambitious and visionary, says, let's put a man on the moon before the end of the 1960s, which would be December 31st, 1969. They are alleged to have gone within 5% of that deadline. He was, of course, assassinated. His successor, Johnson, came, and they probably during his administration figured out they could not go to the moon. They could either tell the public and swallow that money and pride or pretend to go. And I believe this is one of the reasons why he didn't run for re-election. There's only two presidents in world history who were incumbents who did not run for re-election. He's one of them. And I think he knew faking the moon landing was coming down the pike. And of course, he's from Texas where NASA and all that junk is. So who knew faking the moon landings would work? It might work, it might not work. But if you were president and that blew up in your face, that'd be how you'd be remembered throughout all time. And I think that's one of the reasons why he didn't run for re-election. And in 1967, you know, there was a different crew who was going to be the first crew to go to the moon. It wasn't Neil Armstrong. It was Commander Gus Grissom. Gus Grissom was the most beloved of all the astronauts because in an earlier Mercury flight, when his space capsule hit the ocean, the explosive bolts were accidentally triggered. It started filling with water, started sinking down to the bottom of the ocean. In addition to this, the guy had like 8 rolls of bank nickels in his pockets because he had a son in elementary school and he wanted to give out these nickels to his classmates and say, here's a nickel that's been in outer space. So he did it for the kids. But as he's sinking to the bottom of the ocean, he starts thinking, you know, maybe that wasn't such a great idea. And when he confessed this at the press conference, you know, they just started laughing and he was laughing. And then someone asked him, were you afraid? And he said, of course I was afraid. He took this Superman persona of the right stuff and he softened it and he said, of course I was afraid. And everybody loved him. He was a pretty good pilot. But I'd say the main reason he was chosen because he had just the best PR of all the astronauts. Well, In 1967, the higher-ups knew they were probably going to fake the moon landings, but it's on a need-to-know basis. Still 2 years down the pike. So they had not yet, apparently, informed the astronauts that this was a likely scenario. And as Gus Grissom, preparing to be the first man to walk on the moon, risking his life, risking never seeing his wife or children ever again, right? Mm-hmm. He makes all of these schedule slippages, you know, does memo after memo about all of this maintenance problems with the rocket. He says they are 10 years away from reaching the moon, not two. And as he started complaining up the chain of command, the higher-ups knew they weren't going to go anyway. And they were probably, at the most, just going to orbit the Earth, which they had already done. So why bother fixing this stuff and wasting all this money on something we're not going to use? But that made him very frustrated. And a few weeks before his death, he took a lemon the size of a grapefruit, and he clipped a coat hanger at the bottom, stuck the lemon in the middle of it, turned the hook around, and he hung it on the entrance to the top of the moon rocket. And without permission, he held an impromptu press conference, because as he complained that all these things should be fixed and they weren't, he was pissed off. So he used the media to get his point across. And so they came in and photographed a lemon that he had hung there. He said, "This thing is a lemon." Hmm. Well, a few weeks later, he dies. Everyone knew he was so blackballed. You know, the other astronauts were like, "You got guts, but let me stand over here in case lightning strikes." So if he had an accident, it would probably look too suspicious. So they killed two other guys along with him to make it look like they weren't singling him out. And they set them inside the space capsule in a ground test. The rockets weren't even being fired. They pressurized something the size of a small bathroom at 3 atmospheres of 100% oxygen. Now, under those conditions, asbestos, the most flame-retardant substance on Earth, burns like tissue paper. And they smelled smoke once. They said, "Sit tight." They smelled smoke a second time. They were told to sit tight. And there was a fire. And everyone assumed that they died because of the fire.
There is definitely much more to that story, which can be found on www.overcoat.org. That's me, Matt Bua, and Jesse Berkowitz's website. And this will conclude the show. Thank you, Peter Lavenda, Bart Sabrell, William H. Kennedy, and Free 103.9.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm. Over and out.